This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Great to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. We were talking tech with Kevin Sebastian. He was answering your questions and looking behind the headlines too, including how are Tinder users spending their time on the app. We met the author Christopher Hill, his book From the West to the Middle East, talking about his trauma, his faith and his vulnerability. How to volunteer here in the UAE over the summer. One charity shop needs your help. And speaking of fashion, if you've got a creative kid who wants to work in the industry, maybe even in engineering or sustainability, news of a competition to keep them out of mischief come September. And as ever, it is pets and vets. It was Dr. Hannah Rolls on the line to answer your questions, and we were learning more about reading dogs. Could your pooch be the perfect reading companion?
Pets and Vets
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer,
in association with Royal Canin, the trusted expert in nutrition for your cat and dog.
Talking reading dogs this afternoon, not dogs that can read, although I do not doubt the intelligence of any of these animals anymore. Joining us is the founder, Carolyn Thompson, explaining a little bit more about what it's all about and perhaps how you or certainly your kids could be getting involved. Carolyn, thank you so much for being with us today. For anyone who's not familiar with the concept of reading dogs, what is it all about and where did the idea come from initially?
Reading Dogs has been running in the UAE for 3.5 years now. What we do is we take a team of trained dogs into schools or private venues, nurseries, and they help children build up their confidence in reading aloud. It's something that's quite popular around the rest of the world. There's a lot of similar programs in Europe, the UK and the US, but we're the only one that are delivering the programs here. Since our launch, we've been running weekly school sessions in around about 34 schools throughout Dubai and Abu Dhabi.
Now, not to ask the obvious, but why do you think it works? What do the kids get out of these sessions by having the animals with them?
I think the dog's a friendly face. So if a child is nervous about reading aloud, they all of a sudden feel in a position of power. They're reading to the dog and the dog's not judging them. So if they can be a bit intimidated by reading to peers, the dog becomes a nice, relaxing experience for them. And they, like I said, not judging, not correcting them, and just allowing them to read at their own time.
And again, I'm playing devil's advocate. What if that child's afraid of dogs? Is that not compounding their fear?
Yeah, that's a slight issue. Although, saying that, we do have a number of children that have started the sessions and been fearful of dogs, or perhaps their parents have had a fear and don't want that to be instilled in them. We very much allow those children to work at their own pace. So what you will find is, if they're a bit nervous, they tend to start out at the back of the classroom, usually close to the door. And as the weeks progress, they'll come closer and closer, and they become more familiar with that dog. And we've had some great results. Parents have contacted us to say that we've helped children overcome that fear and understand how to safely interact with dogs. But that being said, if the child was particularly scared, we obviously wouldn't put them in that position.
It must be an amazing thing to see that growth in confidence and comfort. It takes a very special animal to be able to do that, to foster that confidence, yes, and that trust. I know you're holding, you've been recruiting new reading dogs recently, and I know you've got an assessment over the weekend. Can you tell us about some of the criteria that you look for in an animal to come forward and take part in the reading sessions in particular?
Yeah, of course. So there's no particular size or breed or age of dog that we're looking for. You'll see from our team that it's a really mixed bag, from thoroughbred dogs to mixed breed dogs. And it's really all about their personality. So looking at their temperament and seeing whether they would suit the reading situation, the reading with children situation. They have to be very patient. Children are desperate to touch them and explore their ears and their tail and everything. So they have to be patient. They need to understand children. They have to be very well socialized because the school environment, as much as we control the reading session, getting them into that session is quite noisy, and they come across a number of groups of children, and there's always snacks about. So it really takes a very calm dog that's not kind of overwhelmed by any situation, not fearful, very well socialized. And what you'll find is a lot of the dogs that we work with actually love this type of work. They really enjoy it and get excited when they're going into school. And that's what we're looking for.
So I know you're having the assessment this Saturday afternoon. What will happen in that session, and how can you make sure that children are safe, the dogs are happy, and you know, make sure everyone leaves, well, hopefully with some new recruits in your gang?
That's what we're hoping for. So the assessment day is carried out by our team, but also by our qualified dog trainer, Mena. So when the dogs come down to the assessment day, they've already met a set number of criteria. So they've had health checks, vet checks. We know that they know all basic commands, sit, stay, recall. We know that they've been experienced, they have experience with children. And then when they come down, Mena meets with their owner and really starts to understand their background, where they're from, their age, their personality, any likes and dislikes. Obviously, there's warning signs for us if a dog's not friendly with other dogs or reacts to loud noises or sudden noises. So Mena will assess all that. And then we run practice reading sessions where the dog interacts with a smaller group of children. And we're there to manage that dummy reading session as such to ensure it's safe, both from child safety aspect, but also from kind of COVID and safe. Once we identify dogs that we feel have the right fit, they then enter a training program, which can take up to 3 months. So that's an initial training program and then on-the-job training. And those dogs, again, are reassessed on a quarterly basis. So it's very much about finding the right dog with the right personality, but also the right owner who wants to participate in this type of scheme. Because there is a lot of work that comes from their side as well in terms of interacting with children, but also ensuring their dog is trained and healthy and has all regular grooming and vet check.
What's happening with sessions now? Because I know obviously COVID threw a bit of a spanner in the works with that, Carolyn.
It did, unfortunately. So we were delivering sessions up until March last year. And then when COVID hit, we had to stop everything and we switched to online sessions. And whereas the online sessions have a place, they're not the same for children as having face-to-face sessions where they're able to interact with dogs. So we have just restarted our sessions. We're running summer sessions every Saturday at Eggs and Soldiers in Times Square Mall. Then from September onwards, we'll also be back in schools delivering reading sessions and happiness sessions and other therapy sessions. We initially launched Reading Dogs, and what we found is that we were having requests from school for other types of sessions. So more where the dog becomes a companion dog to school or the child. So they go in and they can take any format. So it's very much about promoting happiness and well-being with children. So we've delivered singing sessions, we've had painting sessions, some yoga sessions with the dogs, or we bring the dogs into a number of the colleges and universities during exam times to help students manage stress and just have a bit of a break during study time. So that's kind of where the happiness element comes from.
Reading dog yoga, doga before?
Yeah.
What was that like?
Oh, it's brilliant. It was one of the colleges here. So what better way to enjoy a yoga class than with a furry friend wandering about trying to copy your poses?
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the trusted expert in nutrition for your cat and dog.
It is one of my favourite hours of the radio week, answering your questions about all things animal. So if you do have any worries about, it could be a health issue you've noticed in your animal, it could be an ongoing health issue that might need some renewed advice. Maybe it's a strange behavioural quirk and you need some expert advice. don't turn to Dr. Google, turn to Dr. Hannah Rolls, St. Vincent Animal and Health and Royal Canin UAE's vet, is on hand to help. Dr. Hannah, it's, we're going to look at some headlines before we get to the many messages on 4001. I don't know if you saw this headline, the rise of pet detectives in Sydney. One alarming thing, I mean, we saw the UK pet prices going through the roof, but we've also seen a rise in thefts of animals, which is just a horrible, horrible thing, which means pet detectives are real. Have you heard about such a thing here in the UAE? Please say no.
I have never heard such a thing in the UAE of a pet detective or actually a pet theft, but I think I've been very lucky.
It's a good job, though. Quite fancy being a pet detective. But obviously helping out the heartbroken owners around the world. There is, yeah, a new breed of dedicated sleuth helping track down your mystery pet. There's one called Anne-Marie who specialises in cats, dogs, rabbits, ferrets, goats, birds and horses. Quite hard to hide a horse, I would imagine. So we are with you this afternoon to take your questions. As I said, everyone who contacts the show will automatically go into the draw to win a goodie bag from Royal Canin. So it could just be a simple photo and a message, but we are here to answer your questions as well. Dr. Hannah, a message from Rach has come through saying we've got a 10-month-old Ridgeback. Massive dog. We're working hard on training him, but he jumps up a lot. Understandably, people find him frightening. Is this adolescence? Is it just a phase? I can hear the hope in that message. 10-month-old Ridgeback, what does Rach and her family and maybe neighbours need to know?
Oh, bless him. A lot of it will be in enthusiasm. Of course it will. And I think the problem with the jumping up side of things is it's as much to do with the behavior of the person approaching him as it is his behavior. And especially at this age, you know, he's still learning lots and he's still learning his basic manners and how to behave, and the excitement will just take over. So I'm sure with the basic training that they're doing, part of it is how they behave towards the dog as well. And that when you approach him, you try and act very calm and not encourage this jumping up behavior, and then you have the chance to reward him when he calms down, and he'll learn that actually he gets more attention and more fuss when he's on the ground, all four paws are on the ground, and he's not sort of jumping up for it. But that does mean that whenever guests come over or neighbors, they need to be told to do the same thing. So it might not be so much training him as training everybody else and giving them a heads up. That's what you're trying to do. He might jump up, but please just keep your arms folded or don't do anything until he's settled down, and I'll give you a treat to give him so that he knows that he's been good. So everybody training, I think, in this situation, not just the little Ridgeback, who won't be that little at 10 months old, I can imagine.
I wouldn't imagine so. But can I ask, what is a typical age of adolescence in dogs? What would you categorise in terms of months or even getting into a year plus?
Well, that depends on the size of the dog. Oh. So we do know that our smaller dogs sort of go through their adolescent phase and reach their adult size much quicker. They grow very quickly and they don't really have that far to grow, if that makes sense. So say Dachshunds and Chihuahuas will be their full adult size and have hopefully gone through the teenager stage by the time they're about 9 or 10 months old. Whereas our Ridgeback, for example, he won't be fully grown until almost 18 months to, you know, some of the big breeds of dog take 2 years to get to their full size. So their adolescence can probably last quite a bit longer and be possibly a bit older than owners appreciate.
Mm-hmm. I think I did like the questions that just a phase, spoken like a true pet parent, because I think all parents have had that with their children as well, going, is this just a phase? And I look back to when our dog Jarvis was a puppy, and I don't mind saying it, he drove me absolutely mental. He would eat, I'm not joking, I hated him. I was like, I really can't cope with this dog. He ate flip-flops, he ate my Kindle, he ate sunglasses, he chewed corners of coffee tables. I remember saying to my husband, like, I am just so over this, it's driving me crazy. And then, sure enough, you kind of look back and you're like, oh, it's been a while since he's chewed anything. You come through it. But when you're in the moment, in pet parenting and child parenting, it can really get you down. It can really affect you. You know, Rach is here saying, you know, worried about people finding it frightening. It might be chewing. Often it is a phase. Sometimes it does need the professionals to be brought in from a behavioural point of view as well, though. If you've got any questions, Dr. Hannah, get in touch. Alex has got a question about dandruff. it's not the health show for people, it's a health show for animals. Alex is saying, our female cat Minnie is all black. Her coat is actually really soft and shiny, but she does have a fair bit of dandruff. I spoke to the vet and she didn't seem fussed about it. I try and brush her as much as she'll tolerate, but I was wondering if I could buy some sort of supplement. Both our cats are molting like crazy just now, so I don't know if it's making it look worse. When is it cause for concern, do you think, Dr. Hannah?
Well, I would take comfort in the fact that the vet is not concerned, because the first thing that we do is obviously have a good rifle through the coat and check and see. So it will be probably coming from the skin. The dandruff is sort of flakes of dry skin, really. So it's a skin problem, not so much a coat problem, although they're very, very interlinked. So we would be checking to see any other signs of inflammation in the skin. So any signs of pinkness or redness, because animal, our dog and cat skin, often it's pigmented, so it looks darker, but it shouldn't be pink. It should be sort of almost white, like a very, very light pink. So any areas of pink or redness are signs of irritation. So that's what we'll be looking for, alongside anything that looks raised or angry. And then the other thing is she itchy? That's always the big question. Is this flakiness and dryness of the skin, is that making her uncomfortable? Is that affecting, you know, the way she is? Brushing is always a really good idea, because it helps to stimulate the circulation there, and it helps to get rid of, you know, any dead hairs that naturally need to come out. That really helps, especially if they're molting. But I would definitely ask your vet for a recommendation for either a diet that is designed to tailor for a longer haired breed of cat, because they are out there, either more breed specific or more condition specific, and they have higher levels of omega-6 predominantly fatty acids, which are what will really help with the skin and coat condition. And also they have adjusted sort of protein levels. You could alternatively, if you like your maintenance diet that you're on, you could add those supplements separately. But those are your sort of two options, and ask your vet for their recommendation, because they'll have something that they have tried and tested and they know that works.
All right, Alex and Minnie, I hope that helps. No name on this message. So by all means, if you prefer to be anonymous, it's absolutely fine. If you want to win that goodie bag, we do need your name on your message to 4001. Message here saying, I know I'm being nosy and I should butt out, but neighbours have a young cat, less than a year old, who recently had a litter of 5 kittens. Neighbours refused to spay the cat because they wanted kittens. They're now 5 weeks old. Husband and son were playing with them in our garden last night. We adopted our cats when they were 7 months old, both being fixed, so I've got no experience of tiny kittens. But they shouldn't be allowed out to roam by themselves at that age, should they? So little kittens from next door, 5 weeks old. Should they be allowed out, kind of interacting with other families and even other cats at that age, Dr. Hannah?
No, definitely not. They won't be able to have their first set of vaccinations until they're 9 weeks old. And in fact, I would say that this is the real danger period, the period that we worry about, because if they're being fed by their mother and they're receiving sort of maternal antibodies via the milk, that starts to decrease now. So at 5 weeks, we expect them to be almost completely weaned off the milk. So that maternal antibody that they receive will be waning. But they're not old enough yet to have the vaccination, which will stimulate their own immune system to give them protection. So they're in the veterinary opinion, not just mine, they're in the most dangerous period for picking up infectious diseases or infectious viruses predominantly that can survive in the environment. So even if you live somewhere where you don't see that many outside cats that you're aware of, it doesn't mean those viruses still aren't able to remain within the environment. So we do say keep them inside, keep them to their litter, don't bring any outside animals in. And when you bring them to the vet, keep them in the carrier, you know, but more for puppies, you know, don't put them on the floor of the veterinary surgery until they have been fully vaccinated. They must be as sort of isolated, safely isolated as we can.
All right, really helpful. Thank you, Dr. Hannah.
Pets and Vets.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
In association with Royal Canin, the animal before the owner.
Great to have you with us. It's 20 minutes past four. Get any questions in for Dr. Hannah Rolls as soon as possible. She's the Royal Canin UA vet and is on hand to take your questions about your health or behavioural issues to do with your animals. Brinda's been in touch. Brinda's got a rescue dog called Phoenix, and she's saying, got a lovely rescue for the last 3 months, building up to leaving him on his own for short periods. I've got a camera that allows me to see part of the room when I'm not there, but due to the shape of the room and furniture, I can't always see him. Was wondering if there's a recording device that would let me know if he barked or became distressed. Don't want to listen the whole time if he's quiet. Just want to know when he's not. Does such a thing exist, or am I going about the whole thing wrong? Oh, I remember those early days of not being sure if they're going to be all right. And oh, it's upsetting. It is really distressing sometimes, and the thought of them being distressed when you're not there to help. Have you heard of anything that would be useful, Hannah, or any reassurances for Brinder about leaving Phoenix alone?
I have, but when I was thinking about it when you were just talking there, I think I've got it confused with, because I'm sure there is something out there that is essentially like a baby monitor, and I thought it was called a Furby, but now I'm starting to think that that's one of those toys with the big eyes.
It is, yes.
So now, don't quote me on that, I think that perhaps I have confused these two products, but I'm sure there is something that not only can you use it as a camera.
I wonder if a baby monitor would work. It might work.
Well, maybe, but a baby monitor surely would, you could do the same thing, or perhaps this Furby perhaps invented
we'll do some Googling.
Specific monitor.
We will do some Googling for you, Brinder. Don't worry. Leave it with us. Gianna, I think you're my spirit animal. Gianna's asking on 4001, for some reason, our dog barks the loudest when I'm putting the kids to bed. How can I reset his routine so he sleeps around the same time? That would be nice. I'd also like to have a shout out to my neighbours. If they could stop like revving jet skis and letting off firecrackers at bedtime, that would be really helpful for my routine. Can you reset a dog's routine so they're not barking? What is it around this bedtime that might be setting this dog off, do you think?
Possibly the lack of attention, maybe. You know, if you're away, then he's barking or she's barking to find out where everybody is and what's going on. And now, I don't know that you can reset to make sure he's asleep at that time, but I'd say you can definitely reset to make sure that he's otherwise occupied. So maybe move a meal time slightly, adjust when dinner time is, and maybe use something like an activity pad or a snuffle pad or a maze feeder, you know, the puzzle feeder, so that you can prolong the period of time that the meal takes by sort of hiding the kibble all around that. And that might keep him occupied for a little bit longer. And then at least he's hungry as well, or full even, the opposite of hungry. He'll be full when he's finished doing all of this, and he might want to rest. And hopefully that should give you a window of opportunity to have put the children to bed, or at least reset him so he's not expecting playtime and social interaction, but he's expecting his dinner, or he's expecting this snack and this time to sort of play with him, play by himself.
Got you. Makes sense.
Yeah. Try that, I'd say.
Also, we've been using lots of YouTube of, you know, calming spa dog music. It's actually quite pleasant, and they actually do respond to it.
Please tell me that's a genre of music, calming spa dog music.
Of course it is. It's 2021, Hannah. Some music for everything.
I want to go to that spa.
Oh, Sean's message saying the lollipop nanny cam has sound notifications. Sean, you are a legend. We'll pass that on to Brinder. Thank you so much. No name on this message saying my cat is about 9 months old. She scratches her neck all the time. We did get this consulted. However, the vet didn't seem to find an underlying issue. Could this be just a habit?
Not really. I don't think so at that age. I'd be worried that there was, you know, a true itch. And I think the other thing that we are concerned about when it's around the face and neck with animals is that it particularly with cats, that it could be allergic in origin. So I think it's definitely worth going back to the vet. And also, I think that the good test is whether or not they do it in front of the vet with an itchy sort of scratchy problem. Is if it is more behavioral or more habit forming, they won't do it when they're in the vets because they will be distracted and the adrenaline will be pumping a little bit and they won't do things that are sort of more habit forming. But if she does scratch her neck in front of the vet, then I think we can safely say that there's a true irritation and a true itch there. And then we need to investigate a little bit further to find out why.
Good litmus test indeed. Dr. Hannah, we're out of time. Thank you so much for your insights this afternoon. Always appreciate
Sorry about the Furby.
It. Hey, I've just got a vision of that big-eyed toy from the 90s.
That would be petrifying, wouldn't it?
Oh, wouldn't want that barking anywhere near me. But we will find out. But thank you so much to Sean for saying the lollipop nanny cam can flag that for you, Brinder, and for Phoenix as well.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking tech, Kevin Sebastian joining us this afternoon, aka Knox Voyager. He is here to take your questions and we look behind the headlines as well. Kevin Sebastian, loads of sales around at the moment. Have you put your hand in your pocket? Have you bought anything?
I did, actually. I'm basically buying a PlayStation 4 for my brother-in-law, and yesterday was Prime Day, as you know. And they had a very good deal where I got the PlayStation 4 for 1,200 dirhams, actually.
So there you go. I bought a kettle for 89. It's not quite the same, is it, really? It's a bit of plastic had melted around the plug. I was like, oh, I'll treat myself to a new kettle. It's all exciting times over in the farmer household, I can tell you. I've already got a number of questions for you, Kevin, that have come in on 4001. I think a lot of people are looking at spending and taking advantage of some deals right now. But before we get to the SMSs, let's have a look behind the headlines. Why Amazon should pay attention to Shein. Now, for anyone who's not familiar, Shein is a massive fashion e-commerce retailer. I have to be honest, I haven't dabbled into it because I've got enough online shopping go-tos. Why do you think Amazon perhaps could be learning a thing or two?
So I basically came to know about Shein through my wife, and I suddenly started seeing things pop up on the door or different time periods, whether they were random knickknacks like cushion covers or light bulbs, and then I'm like, how much are you spending on all of these things? Because I was getting very concerned. And then she showed me the invoice, the bills, and the cushion covers were 9 dirhams. The lights, which normally would cost around 100 dirhams, was 12 dirhams. I was floored, and I'm like, okay, clearly there's a quality issue here at stake. But turns out, like, these are really, really well-done products. In fact, not just with the random stuff, there's also clothes as well, and Shein as a company are a fashion brand, and one of the things that really, really surprised me was their algorithm and how they found out ways to actually change the way the entire shipping process is done. And that's what floored me as well, because normally when something went wrong with Shein, especially when Marsha got her thing that did not work out for her, they replaced it within 24 hours. So I was totally astounded.
Now, it is massively popular, as you say, kind of people who are a bit budget conscious. The app has been downloaded 14 million times in the US in March, according to Apptopia. So it is dominating. As I said, I haven't dipped my toe in. If anyone out there is a passionate user or indeed has any issues, let us know. Now, I want to go to the text line before we get back to the headlines. A question from Louisa saying, any thoughts on underwater cameras? Can't afford a GoPro. Just need a point and shoot. Swimming and snorkeling, not diving. Good question. I'd love one too. And what are our options? Because GoPro does seem to dominate this market.
They do, but generally GoPro are very enthusiast level great cameras. But then Sony also does a few of their own. Sony has something called the Action Camera, which you can get anywhere between 800 to 1,000 dirhams, depending on how much of a quality you want in them. But the base model, the Sony Action Camera base model, is actually pretty decent enough to get things on 4K, and they're very nice. You can take them to pools. You can take them up to a certain depth, not as much as the GoPro, but it still does a very decent job as well.
There you go, Louisa. Check out the Sony. There might be a deal around. Now, not something you or I need to think about, Kevin Sebastian, for we are happily married, not to each other, before the Dubai rumour mill starts going. But Tinder users have changed their behaviours. What is the latest from the world of online dating?
So in the world of online dating, basically, Tinder is now finding that there's no user engagement, obviously, because over the past year, there was the time period where people couldn't meet, and it still is for certain countries as well. But they saw the activity going up by 19%, and their users now have, if you remember how Tinder works, it is basically you find a profile, if you like the person, you swipe right, if you don't, you swipe left, and that's when a lot of internet jokes that are coming out of it, because you could suddenly change your life with a single swipe. Now, Tinder are realizing that there's more to it than just swiping, because people are obviously spending more and more time online. Like, a lot of people on Tinder who met other people on Tinder obviously did not get to meet them in person. So a lot of that activity was spent on the app, talking to them for a long period of time, doing virtual meets and doing virtual events together. And honestly, that's just the future being accelerated right now, because that's how things are moving now in the digital day and age. I know we sound very old-fashioned when it comes to love, but especially for anyone who is not socially switched on, they're very introverted, they don't have the mental energy to go to a place to find someone or meet somebody. This is the alternative. So basically, that's the only alternative they have in terms of these online applications.
I mean, I do thank my lucky stars every single day that I never had to use online dating for a number of reasons. Mostly judging people by their poor grammar. No one would get past the Helen Farmer language skill test. I don't know what it is. And to be honest with you, this last year, I think it has been actually a bit of a lifeline for an awful lot of people who have felt cut off from family and friends. And I really feel for people, I'm thinking more to do with people in the UK, to be honest, where it was that much stricter for that much longer, who've effectively missed out on a year of wanting to meet someone. I mean, we know that when you get to a certain point of your life, and it's very different what that age is, depending on your own thoughts and own experiences. But to miss out on finding love and starting a relationship, even starting a family, that is a significant chunk of time. So more people turning to apps like Tinder, conversations being 32% longer. People, these are probably most likely users who should be doing a bit more working from home, but instead are doing a bit more dating from home.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking tech this afternoon, tech editor and self-confessed geek and lightsaber swinger. Kevin Sebastian's with us today, answering your questions and looking behind the headlines as well. Let's go to the text line, if you don't mind. Luna's been in touch on 4001 saying, my husband's birthday is coming up. I want to get him an electric shaver. What's the best brand? You're a bit of a beardy man from time to time, Kevin. How do you groom?
So there's two schools of thought. So basically, you have to have a budget. I'm not sure what Luna's budget is, but you can either have a Philips Multigroom 7000 series, which I swear by. I personally use it. It is for 196 dirhams on Amazon right now. There's a sale going on, so that's great. If, however, you want to splurge a little bit more, say 1100 dirhams, oof, you can get the Philips Prestige, which is both a dry and wet electric shaver, which means that you can take it to the washroom and have little to no trouble doing the necessary work.
You won't get electrocuted, which is always worth a few extra dirhams in my book. There you go, budget and a bit of a splash-out option for you, Luna. And happy birthday. Hope you haven't ruined the surprise, but happy birthday to your husband. Ramesh saying, do you review air purifiers? What is the best one? Nothing too pricey, please. I still don't really understand what air purifiers are or how they work, but let's see if we can help Ramesh out. Have you ever put some to the test in your time here in Dubai?
I have reviewed air purifiers, actually, but the one that Ramesh is obviously looking for, a budget-conscious one. The one that I reviewed personally is the LG PuriCare, which is really good. In fact, this is a very visible testament to my mom's cleaning skills. So when I got it in for review, back when I was living with my parents, I put it in my room, and the purifier obviously went nuts, saying that the air quality is really bad. And obviously, my mom was proven right, and then I said, you know what, let me put it in your room, and it turned green, so the air was absolutely
Kevin
fresh. Yes,
dirty.
So the PuriCare is an amazing product. There is one for 800 dirhams, and there's a top tier one for 1000 dirhams if you are living in a big house. However, if you're looking for something a bit more economical, there is the Xiaomi air purifier on Amazon again. It's for $469. Philips also has one for $525 as well. So it really comes down to your brand preference. But the Xiaomi one is very popular here because it's a very inexpensive one and it does a good job.
Thank you very much. Also, they need to look nice as well, just saying. Right, not just about functionality. Yeah. If you're having it in your home, you've got to think about the aesthetic too. Now, we've talked about online dating, which I don't do.
Yeah.
Now we'll talk about Snapchat, which I also don't do, on account of being just a bit old, to be honest. And having heard their latest news about removing a feature that displays how fast a user is traveling when taking a picture or video footage, it just proves to me again that this has no place in my life. Now, parent company Snap says it's because the speed filter was barely used, but they've also had a bit of trouble as well about being sued. Tell us about that, Kevin.
So back in 2017, there was an incident with Snapchat for people. I believe there was a car accident incident because teenagers basically used a speed filter and they wanted to take it up to a very high speed just to put it in their story. unfortunately, they passed away because of it, and the parents of those teenagers are now suing Snapchat for it. The case is still ongoing, and Snapchat obviously have gotten into a lot of trouble for it. I am very much on the fence over here about this particular incident because, one, when you do have the internet at your palms, it is your personal responsibility to know how safe you are to use it. Also on Snapchat, I'm sure that they should have known this. If they have put in a speed filter, they should have probably realized there are people who are going to abuse that.
Of course. So, of course. That begins, it's a bit like, you know, taking the ultimate selfie and you've got people hanging off cliffs and buildings, to, you know, becomes
exactly.
It becomes
teenagers are very impressionable.
Totally. We know now the brain is not fully developed until we're 25, which explains an awful lot of my behaviour when I first moved to Dubai. So, you know, let's help people help themselves by not encouraging silly behaviour. So a good thing that this has been removed. I just want to squeeze in one last question that's come in from Mariam, if you don't mind, because I think an awful lot of people are perhaps, as we get into the summer months, might have a bit more time, might be doing a bit of sorting and decluttering. Mariam saying, I've got a 1 TB. Is that terabyte? Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. I'm allowed to remain on the tech show. Got a 1 TB hard drive full of pictures and videos, won't fit in Google Photos. Where can I save them just in case my hard drive goes kaput? Thank you. How can we help Mariam and indeed anyone else that's looking to do a bit of photo admin?
So for photographers, professional ones use this service actually. It's called iDrive. It offers 3 TB, 5 TB, I believe, for $3.99 a month. However, if you're looking for something a bit more physical, like a drive, I know you already have a 1 TB hard drive, but my personal advice would be to get something called a NAS, or a network access storage drive, which is basically a physical drive that connects to its own personal cloud. So you can obviously upgrade the space as you go. It's called the WD or Western Digital My Home, and it's got 2 TB for the starters for 430 dirhams. It is a one-time purchase. You don't have to pay for monthly subscriptions for it. I highly recommend that people get more physical clouds in it. So, and these drives don't fail because they're connected online. So the data is always online. So in the event of a failure, you can always have a backup.
See, I knew you were asking the right person. Kevin Sebastian, where can people find out more from your reviews? Keep up to date with what you're up to as well.
They can find me on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook on Knox Voyager.
Thank you so much. I will let you get back to probably a bit more online shopping and we'll talk to you very, very soon. Thanks again for all of the advice.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Helen Farmer with you. Asking how would you process childhood trauma? How can you heal from it? For a UA resident we're speaking to now, it's through his faith, through therapy and writing a book. Joined now by Christopher Hill. He's an author. He's written a book called From the West, the Middle East. Originally from Dallas, he currently teaches in Abu Dhabi. And he self-published his first book called From the West to the Middle East. It's a personal account of how he survived PTSD and childhood trauma by coming to terms with his past. Not an easy topic. But as we know, and as people are proving time and time again, there's a huge amount of strength to be taken from vulnerability. Christopher, how are you today?
I am great, Helen. How are you?
I am good. Now, you are a hero of mine because you've been teaching kids through distance learning all year. Not all superheroes wear capes. Are you really okay?
I am okay now.
Good.
But at the beginning, it was a total shift. Yes, okay now.
Good. Honestly, I think teachers are just incredible. You're an amazing example of that. You came to the UAE 3 years ago, but I'd like to go back a little bit further than that and start with your childhood, which is a huge part of your story. You've said there was a huge amount of trauma there because your dad wasn't around. Tell us more about that, Christopher.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for having me on the show.
You're
welcome. I really appreciate it. And I was listening to your last segment about the words. So I am American, so I do understand some of those pronunciations.
I'm so sorry.
But nevertheless, thank you for having me on. So, you know, when I was a kid, there was so much going on in the neighborhoods that I grew up in. And, you know, in a house with siblings, you know, I got along with my siblings very well. However, I was a product of, you know, broken parents at that point in time. Since then, the relationship has been restored and, you know, we're on the right track. But my father was not around as much. And that was just one of the things that, you know, contributed to the trauma that I experienced as a child. But that was the bulk of it, because for a son to not have his father around and have those, you know, fatherly affirmations, that creates a different monster. And so what I would do is I would try to find those affirmations and through other avenues.
You got into quite a bit of trouble at school. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so through elementary school and middle school, you know, I was not your typical boy, I guess what everybody would say. You know, I was very angry. And I guess that was a self-awareness of noticing that my father was not there already at an early age. I had become self-aware of what I was lacking. And so I was so mad, and I would just, you know, express that through fighting, through acting up in school, through being rebellious with teachers. And then on the side of that, you know, as a product of that, I started to not care much about my academics. I failed the fifth grade, and that set me back mentally. And then when I got to high school, I just was on the wrong track, period. It wasn't until I became a senior where I began to get it together. And I felt like by that time it was too late. But I had a wonderful counselor. And that's why I say, you know, anyone in education, not just teachers, are essential to a child's growth and in their future. And my counselor was the person who spoke into my life, who spoke and told me that I could do whatever I wanted to do, even though on paper it looked like I wouldn't graduate.
You hugely turned it around, and you have credited it to therapy and your faith as well. And but you also, you know, there's a huge amount of responsibility that you took on your own part to make that active decision to reach out and say, I need help, and speak to people who could help you.
Yes. So, you know, that's a part of the maturity. And for me, it was a part of just being, I gotten tired of being mad at the world. I had gotten tired of, you know, just sulking in my own misery. You know, there's a famous quote. I know it's widely expressed amongst the African-American community in America that misery loves company. And so I believed and started to see that, you know, because I wanted to stay in my own mess, that I started to now accumulate bad company, mm-hmm. bad people, bad things. I started partaking in things that I shouldn't have. And so that was the straw for me. I had just gotten sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I just knew I had to do something, which is why my faith played a role in that, and therapy, and especially writing this book. Although at the time of me writing the book, I had, you know, been healed from a lot of those things. I had walked through a journey of freedom already through those things, but to relive those things sometimes, that it created some triggers. And so I had to get therapy, even writing this book. So for people who think that they're always, you know, okay, just because they go through a couple of sessions and they think they're over something, you should always be doing a self-evaluation, because it proved itself to be true as I was writing this book.
Really brave to put yourself through that experience, and, you know, it must have been hugely cathartic to do that.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Appropriately now joined by a teacher and a writer, Christopher Hill is with us. He's the author of a book called From the West to the Middle East. Originally from Dallas, he currently teaches in our nation's capital. And after a traumatic childhood, he managed to work through it through his faith, through therapy, and through the catharsis of writing this book. And you are from Texas originally, but a few years ago visited the UAE, Christopher, and you fell in love. What was it about this part of the world that you liked?
Yeah, so when I came to visit the UAE, it was back in 2015, March of 2015. So the weather was still nice. But
I it helps.
Fell in love. Yes, I fell in love. I mean, that was the welcome that I received. But I fell in love with the culture. I fell in love with just how hospitable the people were. I'm from Texas, so I'm from the southern region, from the south of the U.S. And so we have a thing that we say, it's southern hospitality. And it felt just like that for me. And as a historian, as a history major, And as a social studies teacher, I am a sucker for knowledge. Like, I love knowledge. I love history. I love culture. And so to be in a place that you could just, it was like a playground for a history teacher. I just fell in love with it. And I knew when I went back home, I told my mom, I said, I'm going to move to the Middle East. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it. And I'm going to move and become a resident of the UAE. And she kind of like, okay, you know, but I mean, I'm here and I'm doing it. And she reminds me of that all the time.
You made it. You made it happen.
Yeah.
And this next part here, it can be quite divisive. People either really take to it straight away, or it can take a little while, if ever, for it to feel like home. And I think you're right. A lot of it comes down to who you meet and finding your tribe. And how have you built that community around you?
Wow. Just ordained. You know, the people that I've met here, I've met some wonderful people, from my coworkers to some friends that I knew even before coming to the UAE. But I have, you know, I had a close circle, close tribe. Kimberly Phillips, Joshua Heading, and Janella Heading, they were my backbone when I first moved here. And we just automatically became family. And for me, although I met some, like I said, I met some wonderful people, we always understood each other. And it wasn't a time where we were having a confusing moment that one of us didn't understand. And so just to not only have friends who felt like family, but to have someone who understood everything that you were going through, and mm-hmm. someone that you could just be honest with, that really served its purpose for me. And I just, you know, I was appreciative of our friendship, and it was right on time when I needed it.
So writing the book then, as we said, it's self-published. It's called From the West to the Middle East. Who do you think would get something from reading it, Christopher? Who's it for?
This book, you know, my friend asked me one time, you know, what's your gift to the people with this book? And at the time, you know, I was like, you know, conjuring up an answer, but I didn't really understand the question. And so as I've, you know, started writing again, finishing up actually the end of the book, that was one thing that brought me to this view on this is, I want, not a lot of time people check on strong people. And my family, my friends, they viewed me as such a strong individual, a person who was able to persevere, who could just navigate through any hard time and still come out okay, at least is what they thought. But it, on the back burner, because people never checked on me, that left me open to a lot of heartache that I didn't speak of, that left me open to depression, that left me open to a lot of self-inflicted things that I did. And I just want people to understand when they read this book, because a lot of people will be shocked at the accounts that I give. I want people to start checking on your strong friends. Because we pour into people so much. We make sure people are, you know, always their best. But at the end of the day, because we pour into people, we don't have anyone pouring into us. And so sometimes we fall through the cracks. So if there's a gift that I can give anybody with this book, it is to literally check on strong people who you perceive to be strong people.
I think that's so true. And I think, if this last year has taught us anything, we've started to realize that everyone has some kind of personal struggle or is going through something. And as you say, it's the strong people who often don't show it, but that doesn't mean that everything is okay beneath the surface. And I think it's wonderful for you as a young man to be saying this as well. I think that's really, really powerful. And for anyone who wants to learn more about your life, your journey, and what you feel like you have to offer through this book, what's the easiest way of finding it, Christopher?
The easiest way would be on Amazon. The release date is December 18th, 2021.
We cannot stress this enough. When it comes to authors, pre-ordering is everything. So it is there now to find. And please keep us posted. It's wonderful to have you here in the UAE. Wonderful to have you talking so warmly about your experiences here. Have a wonderful summer ahead. Are you going to get a bit of a holiday as a teacher? Fingers crossed.
Oh, yes. I am traveling back home to the United States. So going to see family and friends and going to make up some lost time from last summer.
Good. Enjoy every moment of that Southern hospitality and make sure you come back to us. Take care, Christopher. Thank you so, so much. Christopher Hill, the author of From the West to the Middle East, His Journey from Dallas to here in Abu Dhabi.
home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, we all want to do some good. Sometimes we just need to be shown how to do it. And if you're not going anywhere this summer, one of the things you can do is volunteer. There's been incredible studies done around the benefits of volunteering. It can increase self-confidence, bit of a boost to your life satisfaction. It's been proven to combat depression, can help you stay physically healthy, and obviously connect you with your community. Now, Dubai government, there's a number of platforms for volunteering. There's Dubai Cares, the Community Development Authority, volunteers.ae, and some animal shelters here also accept volunteers. So there are numbers where you can go along and spend your time for a good cause. And one of them, joining us on the phone now, is Thrift for Good. It's a charity shop here in Dubai that rehomes pre-loved clothes and items, raising funds for children's charities around the world. And they could use some more interns and volunteers this summer. Joining us to tell us more, we've got Jennifer Salt, who's the Grassroots Project Director at Gulf for Good. How are you, Jen?
Hi, Helen. I'm good. How are you?
I'm really well, thank you. I'm in training. Gulf for Good is getting some funds from me for Kilimanjaro. I just need to get my knee sorted out.
Yeah, you must be so excited. It is a fantastic climb.
I am really, really looking forward to it. A little bit nervous. I'm now thinking, would it be easier to raise money just by giving you some of my clothes rather than actually climbing the highest summit in Africa? What do you think?
Well, either way, it'll go to help those lovely kids in Larchfield Children's Home. So as you prefer, Helen, and you have great clothes. So very welcome. Very welcome.
Thank you so much. Now, Jen, you've always volunteered. Tell us a little bit about some of the projects and charities you've been involved in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. So I feel really lucky as a Canadian. It's, you know, volunteerism, especially when you're young, it's kind of in our blood. So when I was young, you know, just volunteering in hospitals, and I took a gap year to volunteer overseas. And I think that's when I got addicted to, you know, fundraising for children's charity projects abroad. So I spent time in Nepal and Tanzania. And then when I got to Dubai, I actually joined Gulf for Good first as a volunteer. And then that grew into me working with them. And I've since moved on to start Thrift for Good, which is, you know, the social enterprise, the charity thrift shop on the Palm Jumeirah that's fundraising. We donate 100% of our profits, of course, to Gulf for Good. I think all along, volunteerism has just been a part of who I am and what I do. And luckily, Thrift for Good is a volunteer-run shop. So it's something definitely, that we're behind and we need.
You need volunteers. So we're doing a bit of a call out this afternoon, which is great. It means that Thrift for Good is busy, means the second-hand economy is booming. So yes. Who do you need and what will they be doing?
Yeah, so we definitely need as many people as can help us as possible, whether it's speaking to the customers on the floor and helping us sell items, or the massive amount of work that goes behind the scenes to sort all of these given clothing, to steam them, to price them, to love them. We have people who sew to help fix up things that stain treat clothing so we can bring it back to its best quality, and also volunteers to help us with all the other work we do, upcycling and our online shop and you name it. We have it. We need help. And as a volunteer run business, I know a lot of people are traveling for the summer, so
I know a lot of people who aren't, Jen. I know a lot of people, and also students as well. You know, we've spoken in the past about the lack of opportunities when it comes to young people to actually work here and get something on their resume, on their CV before they might go to university or try to make their way in the world of work. What is the age range or indeed lower and upper limit of people that you'd accept as volunteers?
Absolutely. So we are as open as possible. Part of what we do is providing that opportunity for community and volunteerism. If they're above 16, they don't need to come with their parent. If they're below, we ask the first day they come with their parent just to assess, you know, where they're at. But really, interns, especially during the summer, are our heart and soul. We've developed a really good program to, you know, to train volunteers in retail, to train our interns in retail, the front and back, and everything that they need to know. So I'm quite excited about what we've done here, and we just need the interns now.
Just need some man and woman and maybe some older child power as well. And as you said, there is some customer facing roles there, as you say, working in the shop. There's roles behind the scenes, maybe removing stains or fixing up clothes so they can get the best possible mm-hmm. price, that money going to charity. But as you mm-hmm. said, there's also a lot of work when it comes to the website. A lot of the items or photos are taken and uploaded so people can buy online too. So if anyone's listening and they want to develop their kind of tech experience or they feel like they could really lend a hand in an area of their expertise, please, please, please get in touch. What's the best way of contacting you, Jen? What can how can people reach out and connect?
Thank you, Helen. That's fantastic. So thriftforgood.org, and you'll see a lovely tab called Volunteer, and there you'll see Volunteer or Intern. And we have a sign-up form. Fill that in, and we'll be eager to get back to you and pull you in.
So when I was growing up, I lived about 3 miles away from my two grandmas. I mean, to be mm-hmm. fair, they didn't get on, bless them, at all. But they used to work side by side in Oxfam, which is the British charity shop. And until I was about 12, they used to bring home all sorts of things. They used to call it the boutique. And I thought that there was a very posh shop in our local town called the boutique. No, it was Oxfam, it was a charity shop. But I tell you what, as a child, it was an absolute... Oh, it was like an Aladdin's cave of books and, you know, puzzles, clothes. We used to get so much from it. And I feel like, you know, that has been something that's really lacking for a long time in Dubai, that sense of thrift, and especially for such a transient city where we're always having a sort out. We're always seeing posts about, oh, you know, we're moving house or we're leaving the country. Where can I donate clothes to, shoes to, you know, games and books to as well? So what are some of the items that you're accepting at the moment, Jen, at Thrift for Good?
Yes, so we take anything that's fashion, so bags, shoes, the accessories, obviously the clothes for men, women and children. We can't take house items or furniture or toys at this time just because our storage isn't set up for it. We break more than we sell, but anything fashion, it's very welcome here. And that's definitely one of the benefits of volunteering too. We're talking about starting a Shopaholic Anonymous group. Because the amount of treasure to find.
You get the first pick.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's a benefit. But there's more than enough to go around, that's for sure.
Oh, it sounds like you're doing such an awesome job. And, you know, speaking of someone who went out for lunch recently and the lady at the next table was wearing the same dress as me, good times. Ah. When you do buy pre-loved fashion, that doesn't happen. And there's something exciting about that. There's the thrill of the kind of, you know, the bit of a hauling through things and the trawl over than the haul, maybe I should say, to of that sense of discovery and giving clothes a bit of a second chance. As I said, you can shop online. Would you mind just reminding us of the website, Jen?
Absolutely. So it's thriftforgood.org, and we do our best to upload items there. We drop about 30 items every week, and we're starting to put on our Instagram, Thrift for Good, at least 30 products that we're highlighting every day that people can reserve. And in store we have thousands. We have thousands of items. So definitely it's available there for people to check out.
Sustainable fashion at its finest right here in Dubai. Jen, thank you so, so much for your time. If anyone wants to contact us on 4001, I'm happy to reply with the website so you can head right over to that volunteer tab. Stay out of mischief this summer. Do some good with Thrift for Good.
Home or away.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking fashion this afternoon, and we've heard that, you know, one person's trash can be someone else's treasure, but what about their clothes? At a time when the whole world seems to be hell-bent on throwing away, the pioneering souls behind Junkature are doing the opposite. The fashion competition is all about using recycled materials and challenging young people to design, create and model high-end couture from everyday rubbish. It takes in elements of fashion, design, engineering, environmental sustainability and transforms them into a creative contest. And Katie Brill, Junkature's Vice President for Public Relations and Communications, is on the line to tell us more. Katie, how are you?
I'm not bad, Helen. How are you?
I'm really well, thank you. Lovely to catch up. And it's been quite a year since we last spoke. So tell us a little bit about, well, how have you had to adapt over the course of the last year? How's the competition changed?
Oh my God, it has changed. You know, I wouldn't want to say drastically. I suppose in regards to live events, of course, that has changed as Junket Shore largely bases its competition element on the end product being where these students display their wonderful recycled couture creations in front of the world and their local community at, you know, a showcase and a competition on stage. But for us last year, of course, we had to adapt with COVID-19 and luckily enough for us, we were able to bring the Irish Grand Final, which was currently running at the time, and we were able to televise it and partner with our national broadcaster here in Ireland. But that didn't stop our global plans in taking Junket Shore and the creative programme to the UAE, as well as New York, Milan, Paris and New York as well. And our plans are still very much in place to take the creative programme to schools to the UAE from September. So we're really excited and have lots of onboarding tasks and webinars going on at the moment where we've been in discussion with many wonderful schools in Dubai. I've been lucky enough to be talking to them myself. So we're still very lucky, although it did change slightly. We're delighted to be back on track now as things are looking up. And we'll hopefully have a hybrid event next year to offer the schools and students in the UAE, both a digital side of the competition, but also, fingers crossed, some live events coming back into 2022.
So we are looking for creative kids aged, it's kind of secondary school. So is it like age 12, 13 up to 18?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So what Junket Shore is, it's this global platform for youth creative expression. And really our goal is to enrich and empower the lives of young people through their creativity, but also with sustainability, is we really believe that these youth have the power to, you know, create this lasting positive change that our planet so needs through their own creativity and fashion. And it's then through what we offer, and it is this creative programme to schools and specifically for students between the ages of 13 to 18. And as you said, Helen, in second level education. It's a free to enter year-round program, and our primary creative outlet that we offer is this fashion design competition, as you mentioned, where they're challenged to create wonderful wearable sustainable couture out of nothing but 100% recycled materials before then they're asked to showcase their creations and the backstories and the inspiration stories, as a lot of students like to raise awareness for different climate change issues, or maybe an artist or a designer that they admire, and they do that then to the world in a series of digital and live finals. So it's very exciting.
Now, I've seen some of the photos of the creations that have been made, and some you'd never guess were made from effectively junk or recycled. They simply don't look like they've been cobbled together,
right?
By teens. Some, it's obvious that it's recycled, but it's so beautiful. You know, necklaces made from sea glass, just gorgeous. Can you tell us about some of the materials that have, you know, kind of popped up over the years that have surprised you most?
Oh, most definitely. And I think, you know, you really hit the nail on the head. You know, some of them you look at and you think, my goodness, there's no way that's possibly made from, like you said, sea glass. That was last year's winner, Synergy. Her and her design team, there was three students that created the most exquisite design inspired by El Sab. And it was made from milk cartons and sea glass that they collected from their local beach. And they brought it home and washed it all. And you could see the beautiful colours that then they were able to drill holes and to sew into. And I just thought, wow, what innovation and creativity that those girls showed. Over the years as well, some materials that really blew my mind was, you know, bicycle tires and you know, burst tires that they collected from local garages that were going to be discarded, that they stripped fabric and created a large piece of textile to use. But then you have something as simple as, you know, plastic bags that, you know, really are quite abundant, and that we all have access to plastic food packaging and so on, and students just always seem to get quite innovative with how they manipulate that fabric. And that's what's so wonderful about what these students are doing. They're becoming these artists and circular engineers in their own right, and then they inspire others around them to think about the various elements of waste differently and to see it as a raw material for something else and as the textiles and resources of tomorrow. So it's wonderful to see them getting creative. But yeah, everything goes, guys, when it comes to picking a material for Junket Shore. Whatever you can get your hands on, get creative and don't think it as waste. Think of it as a resource for your Junket Shore design,
as an opportunity. You mentioned it was a team that won last year, so it can it be an individual entry, or teams are okay too?
Yes, absolutely. So students can enter as either an individual or in a group of up to three people, and that must include the model, as there is a performance element to Junkature. So one of the students will have to wear the design and have a short performance element to it, and that's great for some students of the confidence, but that's really where a lot of the self-development benefits come from the programme as well, as the students are really challenged to, you know, have the confidence to get into a design and perform in front of their peers and their local community. So it's a wonderful opportunity for the students.
Is there a prize? I know obviously that it's the taking part that counts, and, you know, nurturing your creativity and having something resume, but is there a prize, Katie?
Yes, of course there is. And like you said, it really is about the taking part. All students will be granted certificates, and we have numerous prizes up for grabs, not just one or two. There's something for all students to strive towards. So we have a monetary prize for the winning school. We have a glamour award. We have the overall designer of the year. There's like Apple packages, vouchers. There's what I personally love about what Junkature offers is in regards to the prizes is the opportunities, the scholarships, the bursaries to study fashion design or any degree that the students would like to go on and study. That's some of the prizes. We also have some opportunities to attend lots of prestigious events. So we've had students attend Cannes Film Festival, wow. The Royal Film Premiere in London. So there's lots of opportunities for students in the UAE to get involved and to take home some great prizes.
Katie, thank you so, so much. We've had a number of messages saying how to get involved. What stage is the competition at now? And if any schools or students are listening, can they still get on board and take part?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm still speaking to schools in Dubai and the UAE at the moment. And it's fantastic to hear from so many enthusiastic teachers and principals. And to name a few schools that are already signed up, we have, you know, GEMS Modern Academy I was speaking to recently, Springsdale, Repton Dubai, Al Barsha. And that's just names some of the wonderful schools already signed up. And there's still time to sign up ahead of September. So anyone that is listening, Helen, who would love to get their school involved, sign up now over on our website or on the Junkature app, and make sure to follow us on our social networks as well, where you can reach out via like DM, and that's at Junkature with two K's, and you can reach out to us, or the easiest way is just head over to our website.
And if anyone wants to just message me on 4001, I'd be happy to send over the link as well, and well worth a follow on social media just to have a look at the sheer ingenuity of some of these young creative people. Absolutely mind blowing. Katie, thank you so, so much for joining us. Hopefully we can welcome you to the UAE come September. Fingers are firmly, firmly crossed. But in the meantime, keep working, keep inspiring, and thank you for all that you do. If you do want the details of Junkature, if you do have a teen who's got eyes on the catwalk, be it as a performer or indeed a designer, engineer, interest in sustainability and the planet, just drop me a line 4001 and I will send you the website.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.